Thursday, October 12th. Cloudy, patchy morning fog and drizzle, high today 59. Right now, wind from the east-southeast at 3, humidity 100%, some fog in the area. Keep the headlights on for safety. 55 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack Andrea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm delighted to welcome back into our studios for her monthly visit to the program, Nan Calvert from the Seno Nature Conservancy. And Nan, oh, did I?
It's okay.
What did I know? Let's get it right.
You can just say Seno Conservancy, but technically it's Seno KRLT Conservancy, but nobody knows what the KRLT means. So
Kenosha Racine Land Trust, I'm
right.
guessing.
Very All good, right. Professor. That's
All
wonderful.
Right. Well, we'll nail the name next time. At any rate, Nan Calvert, as most of you know, joins us once a month and brings with her typically a special guest to talk about some facet of the natural world around us or some issue related to the well-being of our natural environment. And she has brought with her today someone who is actually a good friend of the morning show and overdue for a visit. Nan, explain who you've brought with you today.
I have brought with me Mr. Rick Fair, one of the premier birders in our region. I always think there should be an official word for a birder. You know, you have ornithology. There should be something that mirrors that, but apparently there isn't. And yes, it's overdue. We haven't had anyone from Hawaii for quite some time. And it's fall, and we have the bird migration going on and a few other things. And so it's a good time for Rick to be here.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. And Rick, we welcome you back to the morning show. You are education chair for the local chapter of the Hoy Audubon Society. And is that Kenosha and Racine, or exactly what is the local chapter comprised of?
Well, first of all, thank you, Greg, and thank you, Nan, for this opportunity to talk about birds. Yes, I am the education chair for the Hoy Audubon Society. We are a local chapter of the National Audubon Society, and we represent both Kenosha and Racine counties. And we offer a lot of opportunities for people to learn birds. And we have a lot of field trips and a lot of programs open to the public, and we welcome everybody to join us.
Hmm. Can you say a word about your namesake, Mr. Audubon, and to what extent he is a very direct inspiration in terms of this organization and what you do?
Well, the club started out as the Hoy Bird Club. more people ask me about Hoy than Audubon, because I think most people know the importance of John Audubon. But Hoy was a physician that settled in Racine in the mid-1800s, and he was a very avid naturalist. He had documented many birds that were in the Racine and Kenosha area at that time, and he also studied the plant life. And we named our club after him.
Mm. So the name Audubon is, at least for the most part, well-known, or we hope it is, but someone particularly from another part of the country would not know who Mr. Hoy was.
Correct. And there are about 15 local chapters of the National Audubon Society in Wisconsin. We have maybe three or four meetings a year with the other chapters, and we find out what they are doing in the other parts of the state for their programs and their field trips and things like that. So
very good. It's been a while since you were here, and I know I've asked you this before, but I honestly can't remember the answer of how you first became interested in birds and bird watching. And I'm trying to remember, though, does it have anything to do with the fact that once upon a time you were a mailman?
Well, I spent a little time birding while I was on my break.
Ah, right.
Delivering mail. I'm retired 11 years now, so they can't come after me now.
Right.
But anyway, I had taken an ornithological class at UWM many years before I started getting interested in birding. And then I didn't really study birds or go bird watching until I got until I settled in Racine, and I moved near River Bend Nature Center, and I dug up my old bird book and binoculars and started going out there and trying to learn the birds on my own. And then I ran into some birders and that belonged to Hoy, and that's really beneficial if you want to increase your knowledge by going with birders that really know their birds.
Right. Why did you take that first course at Parkside? Did it just plug a hole, or was it already the seed of interest?
That was at UWM, and
right.
And I was in a curriculum that it was required, so I took the class at that time, and I kind of thought maybe that the instructor was a little bit of a bird nerd, and not realizing that I have become one.
Yeah, right. That was your own destiny. Very good. So essentially, what does the club do, the Hoy Audubon Society? You said you meet three or four times a year. Typically, what occupies your focus?
Well, our club, we have monthly meetings. Oh. And in the winter months, we have our meetings at the Northside Library in Kenosha, and we usually bring in a guest speaker. We recently had him on the monarch butterfly, on the honeybee. We're having one on an arborist in the month of November. And we meet the first Thursday of every month. We also get together and arrange yearly field trips. And we have a number of them coming up in the month of November where we gather along the lakefront in Kenosha and Racine and look for some of the ducks that are migrating in to spend the winter with us. And maybe you'll see loons migrating and other passerines that are migrating. So we do offer a lot of opportunities for people if they want to learn about the birds.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us in the studio, along with Nan Calvert, my co-host for today's program, Rick Fair, who is education chair for the Kenosha Racine chapter of the Hoy Audubon Society. It's interesting, Rick, and Nan, I want you to comment on this, the fact that some of what you've mentioned in terms of programs and so on coming up on the surface don't have anything directly to do with birds. I mean, you're talking about other things like butterflies and honeybees and so on, which I suspect is an acknowledgement of just the interconnectedness of so many of these systems and the fact that birds can't possibly exist and thrive on their own in a vacuum. And things need to be right with the world, in a sense, for things to be right for the birds.
And that's correct, because it, like you say, Greg, everything is interrelated. And we try to bring in different speakers on different topics to try to draw in people of all interests, and we have had really good success with it over the years. We have meetings every month, except one month we have a picnic, and in Christmas we have a Christmas party.
Otherwise, it's serious business.
Absolutely.
Right? So, Nan, say a word about that matter of interconnectedness and how, in a sense, the birds, as much as anything, are dependent on the well-being of the environment around them.
Well, our native bird species, whether they're migratory birds or whether they're year-round residents, depend upon native plant communities for their survival. They might be seed-eating birds. They might be nectar-loving birds. They might be insect-loving birds. But all of those things depend upon native plants and their interactions with those. And it's not just food stuff. It's cover. We have ground-nesting birds. Mm. We have birds that use plant fluff and dried, you know, delicate grass fronds and all of those things for nesting material, certainly for cover. And then, of course, when you have birds of prey, you have to have places for the prey to live. And so our native plant communities afford that. So it really is all connected. It's a system. Nothing exists outside of that system.
Right. So, for instance, if somebody loves birds and wants to see birds, they better care about the environment in which those birds live.
Exactly. That's exactly right, because you can't separate one from the other, because you can't have one without the other. And our native plant communities depend on things like butterflies and other pollinators, and depend on birds that help disperse seeds. So it's all together.
Absolutely.
It's all one thing.
Yeah. Yeah, not easily separated. No. It shouldn't be separated really at all. So, Rick Fair, I know that we're going to be talking about winter birds. Can we talk first a moment about this matter of migration and the fact that at least some birds right now are probably in the midst of major migrations to the south? Are those migrations already underway, and what birds are we talking about that are already embarking on these long journeys?
I like to categorize birds into four different groups. One group are the neotropical migrants, which rely on insects for their basic diet. And most of them, which include the warblers, the vireos, the flycatchers, and the orioles and tanagers, have already pretty much migrated south out of North America, because their main source of food is insects.
And they start to go away around here.
Absolutely. Being cold-blooded, the insects aren't active, and they're not able to get their food. And a lot of people have the misconception that birds leave our area because it's cold for them. And that's not true, because we have a lot of species that spend the time year-round with us. And we actually have species that come down and spend the winter in our milder climate, birds that nest near the Arctic and the boreal forest of Canada. And so that group is mostly out of here. There's a few warblers sticking around that are a little more hardy. But the sparrows are on the move now, so you could get some of the sparrows at your feeders. Ducks and geese and other waterfowl will be moving soon. And it seems like things are a little bit later now. We used to have our Saturday morning field trips in October along the lakefront, where we'd be almost guaranteed to see some of the ducks coming in. But now we've moved them to November, because it seems like they're not coming here as soon as they used to. And a lot of it is based on when the ice forms on the lakes in the northern part of the state or in Canada.
So you're saying that because that ice forms later generally speaking, later than it used to?
It seems to be. I mean, there seems to be a change in climate. Some birds are actually expanding their range further north. Cardinals are one of them. Some of the red-bellied woodpeckers seem to be expanding their range northward. So there is a climate change. There is a gradual warming, and things have changed a little bit. I was on a fishing trip last week, and there were still loons on the lake. And some of them will hang on until they have to leave.
So this is uncommon compared to a few years ago, apparently, where you would have taken a trip at this time of year and not likely seen a loon at all.
Correct.
Interesting. How much happens year to year to affect these kind of patterns? I'm not speaking now about the general warming trend, widely accepted as reality, but I'm talking about when we have a strange year where it's especially warm or especially cold or especially rainy or especially dry. Do migration patterns tend to be affected by those kind of alterations in what usually happens?
Yes and no. The birds that rely on insects for their main source of food, they rely on the length of the day changing. So say a bird is in South America in the springtime, in April, for instance, the day length starts to shorten, and that sets up changes something in their hormones, and they start eating very quickly to build up fat, which is the source of their fuel for the migration. And they get restless, and they start migrating. Once they come into North America, then it's more on the local weather patterns. If you get a strong south wind or a north wind, they move according to that, whether they're moving north or south. And the timing of this is really important because local conditions have, when the insects are out, that's when the birds usually are in that area when they're migrating, and they would fatten up or even have a good source of insects when they're nesting.
Hmm. Nan, I'm curious, out at Seno, where you are headquartered, What kind of birds do you see at this time of year? And is Seno a place where, are you on some of these sort of travel routes for migrating birds?
Seno is a wonderful place to come and look at birds. We have a tamarack wetland, and so if you enjoy birds that frequent sort of intimate, off-the-beaten-path wetlands, it's a really good place to go. We had a couple of nesting pair of wood ducks this year. And, of course, we have great blue herons and sandhill cranes, which are still around, and you can see them getting ready to take their leave, which is always a sad time because I love sandhill cranes. We have a wonderful population of hawks and owls, and it's a really great place, especially in the spring when the warblers start to migrate through. So it's wonderful for bird watching. And, of course, with our woodlands and all of our acorns and our prairie systems, it's a great bird habitat. Mm. Yeah, it's really wonderful.
For those of you just joining us, we have with us Nan Calvert and Rick Fair, who is the education chair for the local chapter of the Hoy Audubon Society. And we're about to talk about that dreaded W word, winter.
Hey, I love winter. Winter is good.
Winter is good. Okay, all right. Nan corrects me. Winter is great. And at any rate, whatever you think of the season of winter, it's also an intriguing thing to talk about in terms of the challenges that winter poses for our birds, especially those that stick around here during the winter months. I know, Rick, one of the things you wanted to talk with us about today is something that we tend to kind of take for granted, not think very much about, namely the feathers. And not only the feathers in terms of just their sheer beauty, but also the importance of feathers when it comes to a bird surviving the winter. Tell us about the wonders of feathers.
Well, Feathers are terrific insulating structures. They keep the bird warm and they keep the bird alive in winter. And there are two basic types of feathers. And one are the contour or body feathers. And if you look at a feather, a contour feather will have a real fluffy bottom to it, which is great for insulation. And then they have their flight feathers, which include the wing and the tail. And these act more like umbrellas. Now, if you looked at a feather under a microscope, you would see little hooks in the feather, and it's kind of like a Ziploc bag. They spend a lot of time preening their feathers to make sure everything is interlocked so that they're not getting any moisture and the heat is not escaping from their bodies. And most birds have a oil gland also, which secretes an oil which they can put over their feathers to make them waterproof. Somebody did an experiment with a black-capped chickadee. The temperature was about freezing, which is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and they put a thermometer right next to the skin of this black-capped chickadee, and the temperature was 70 degrees warmer than the outside temperature. Birds, being warm-blooded, have to maintain even higher body temperature than we have, anywhere from the range of 102 to 109 or 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Wow.
So in the course of a year, feathers wear out from weathering and sun and maybe close encounters with a predator or from parasites, and they have an annual molt, which coincides with the coming of winter. So usually after the nesting season, which is very stressful, then they have their molt. And now they have a new set, fresh set of new feathers, and there's actually more feathers right after they molt. Somebody did another experiment. They took a goldfinch, American goldfinch. In winter, they captured it, and they put it in a large container, and they lowered the temperature and to about 0 degrees. And this bird was able to maintain its body temperature for 7 hours. This is the one that was caught in winter. They also caught another one in July, and they put it under the same conditions, and it was only able to maintain its body temperature 1 hour. So that shows the importance of having new feathers in right before winter time.
You know, I just was realizing that when we think about what a feather looks like, a feather, that we almost always are thinking about those flight feathers that are from the wing or the tail, and you know, we've all seen those if they come loose. But these other kind of feathers that are even more crucial for a bird staying warm, the contour feathers or body feathers. What do those look like if we were, I'm not even sure it's possible, but I suppose it's possible to, you know, if you were to pluck one out, what would it look like, standard feather?
It wouldn't be quite as large as a flight feather, but it would still look like a feather, but it would have a little downy material at the base of it. And these are the ones that really keep the bird warm and insulated.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's still an industry. The Native Americans, they take the feathers of an eider duck, which nests in the very northern reaches of the boreal forest. And when the eider duck female makes her nest, she pulls out some of her body feathers, the contour feathers, and puts it in the nest to keep the eggs warm. Well, they found out that if they took that first set of feathers out of the nest and they use it for making parkas and bed covers to keep warm, that the duck still had enough feathers left to reline it. They wouldn't take the second group, and they were successful in raising their young. And when I was young, I had a quilt or a bed cover that had feathers in it. Probably goose feathers or duck feathers, and it was very warm, except the quills would sometimes come out and prick you at night, but it wasn't the most comfortable. But it's still a major industry, just showing how warm feathers are.
Right. Well, that's what they're designed to be, and they prove to be very, very successful. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, are feathers across various species of birds made of the same sort of thing? I mean,
they're kind of like fingernails, the keratin, very similar to that. But there are other types of feathers. A lot of them change their colors in the spring to be more beautiful to males and to attract females and to show off their territory. Some have plumes, like herons. There are feathers around the beak area of some birds, which help draw in when they're flying. They can collect insects that are flying.
I wonder what a penguin feather looks like up close. Have you ever seen one?
No,
up
I
close?
Haven't. No,
that
I
would
haven't.
Be fascinating because it almost looks like fur. Obviously, it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But theirs are so much more highly specialized.
Yes, I've never seen a penguin feather.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of what prompted my question about these body and contour feathers, too, because when you think about the typical bird, you don't even think about all of it, about the whole body being covered with feathers. We just think about the more pronounced feathers of the wings and the tail, and just don't think about the rest of that body also being covered by feathers. And thank goodness for the winter months.
Well, if you've ever had a Cooper's hawk in your backyard attack one of the birds at your feeders, you would probably see all the feathers laying on the ground.
Nice big pile.
Oh, dear.
You know what I always find fascinating is how black-capped chickadees make it through winter. You know, birds have such a higher metabolic rate than we do, and they require a lot of calories, especially to make it through winter. And how black-capped chickadees actually have a kind of torpor when it's very cold at night, and they sort of lower their metabolic rate, fluff up their feathers, and then when it's time to regenerate for the morning, they can get going, and that way they can serve energy.
To me,
that's just fascinating.
And that's one of the physiological adaptations that birds have. Black-capped chickadees aren't the only ones that can lower their temperature at night. A black-capped chickadee probably can lower its temperature 10 to 15 degrees at night, and that way it's conserving the energy that not burning up at quite as much fat. But it can't get too low because it has to be able to shiver. Like when we shiver, that brings all the blood to our skin and warms us up. That's the same with birds. They have to be able to shiver. And if they lower their body temperature too much, they're not going to make it.
Interesting. So it's like this fine balancing act.
It's not only feathers that keep them warm, but they're both physiological and behavioral adaptations that birds have. It's just a remarkable topic.
Yeah, absolutely.
It amazes me.
Yeah, the whole lot to think about. Anything more about birds keeping warm that we need to know about? Like those changes, behavioral changes?
Well, like some of the physiological adaptations. I was always amazed when I see a duck or a gull standing on the ice and wondering, how do they keep their feet from freezing, or how do they keep from losing all that heat through their legs and feet? And the bird only has a few parts that are not covered with feathers, and one is the bill and the eye area, and the other are the legs and feet. Birds have a specialized blood circulation system called countercurrent, in which the arteries and the veins intertwine almost, and so there's a constant exchange of heat and cold between them, so there's never a big loss of heat. In other words, if the artery comes all the way down to the bare feet and loses all that heat through there, they're wasting the heat and energy. But by intertwining, there's a constant exchange of heat, and so the legs and feet have to stay above freezing, which they barely do, but they're not losing a lot of heat through there. And so that's one adaptation that birds have. Besides what Nan said about the lowering their metabolic rate, they also can sense changes in barometric pressure, and if there's a low pressure coming, that can often mean a storm is coming. And a winter storm, if there's a lot of sleet covering up some of their food sources, so they feed even greater. So if you see that there's going to be a storm coming, watch your feeders. You may see a lot more activity than normal. And a lot of birds also cache their food for winter, like black-capped chickadees and white-breasted nuthatches. And blue jays will hide food in the fall, and they are often remember where they hide them so that they can find them in the winter months. And somebody did another experiment. Well, people have to, you know, get their degrees and do all kinds of studies, but they took a black-capped chickadee from Alaska and a black-capped chickadee from Colorado, the Alaska one being further north, and they put them through a trial where they had them hide the seeds after they fed them. And they found out that the Alaskan chickadees had greater memory and fewer mistakes than the Colorado one looking for the food that they had hidden. And so there's a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is very essential for memory. And the one in the birds in Alaska, because they rely more on hiding their food, had better memory and actually more cells in that part of the brain. So that's another physiological adaptation, a physiological and also behavioral hiding food.
Interesting.
Where do they usually cache their seeds?
In under bark, maybe, or blue jays may hide them in the ground. There's a related cousin of the blue jay called the gray jay, which is called Canada jay. Camp robbers, they're very interesting birds, but they don't come this far south. But they have in their saliva, they have a glue-like substance, and they can hide their food above the snow line. And so they, in the trees, or usually in areas like that. Somebody told me they have seen the white-breasted nuthatches putting a seed under the roof tiles in their house.
Wow, fascinating. So what are the primary birds that we can look forward to seeing around here during the winter months?
Well, one of the categories of birds that are the ones that come here for the winter.
Mm. The guests.
The guests. And I saw my first one last week, are the dark-eyed juncals. They come here in the winter, and in some feeder studies, that has been the number one bird at the feeders.
Mm.
We also have the American goldfinch, house finches, black-capped chickadees, white-breasted nuthatches are very regular, mourning doves.
Mm.
But you also have a group of birds which are very nomadic, that it depends on the food source in northern Canada as to whether or not they will be forced to move further south. And there's a man that does a prediction every year, and you can go to that. His name is Ron Pittaway. You can go to that website, and he makes a prediction of what birds may move further south. And these would be common redpolls, pine siskins, evening grosbeaks, pine grosbeaks, And if you get them at your feeder, that's pretty interesting.
Hmm.
And it's based on the seed crop in their northern regions. because food is the reason why birds move. If their food source is low, like some rely on birch seeds, some rely on the cone seeds of white pines or cedars. And another bird is a red-breasted nuthatch, which may be coming down. So this year, some birds are predicted to come down. Some birds are not predicted to come down.
Well, let's talk about food and the fact that many people enjoy feeding birds. So we should talk about maybe, first of all, if that's a good idea. I mean, does it make sense for us to be feeding birds? Or are we in any way kind of disrupting their natural behavior or causing any kind of issues for birds if we start doing the feeding? Is it okay for us to feed birds?
Absolutely. I feed the birds year-round. The main thing about feeding birds, especially in wintertime, if you're going to feed the birds, and they do start to rely a little bit on your feeders, especially on the really severe cold nights, cold days, rather. But they only rely on your feeders for about 25% of their food in the wintertime. So they're still getting 75% of their food from natural sources. But what I would urge you, if you do start feeding them in winter, keep feeding them. And if you go on a vacation, see if you can get somebody to take over feeding the birds when you're gone. Because they do have their feeders that they like to go to, and they may be in several yards and not only yours. But it is a very enjoyable, relaxing recreation, just sitting and watching the birds.
Do you have particular kinds of bird seed or bird food that you especially prefer to use?
I especially like black oil sunflower seeds. They're very high in fat content. Their shell is not very thick, and they're very easily cracked open and eaten by most birds. In winter, I also provide suet. Woodpeckers, chickadees, nuthatches, they enjoy suet. And there are recipes. You can make your own, or you can buy the suet blocks in the stores. Safflower seed is liked by many birds, especially the cardinal. Supposedly, it's not liked by squirrels. And a lot of people don't like to feed the squirrels in winter, or any time of the year for that matter. But some of the mixed seed mixes, they put a lot of junk in there, wheat or filler, that even though you think you're getting a deal, it's a lot of waste in that, like corn and things like that. But I would, those are the main ones. And also, if you want to attract some of the finches, the red poles, the goldfinches, thistle or Niger seed is, and you can put them in the, and they come in socks, which the birds love those socks. And what's nice is you can get feeders that have real small holes because a lot of other birds are unable to get at that thistle seed. It's a little more expensive than the other seed, but it's not, if the house sparrows, for instance, can't get in there and feed, it'll last a long time.
Right, and if you want beautiful goldfinches in your backyard, it's worth the investment.
And some of the other finches that may move down are attracted often to the thistle or Niger seed.
And I appreciated what you said about when you go out of town. I mean, if you're a devoted feeder of the birds, you shouldn't just leave town for a month without trying to make some kind of provisions to keep that going while you're gone, because the birds, as we were saying, begin to depend on that or certainly look forward to that very much. Well, good. Rick, before we let you go, I know that you have actually quite a long list of events that you want to talk us through in terms of what keeps you and your colleagues at Hoy Audubon so very busy. So what's coming up on the calendar?
Well, this Saturday, October 14th from 9 until 3. We have a hawk watch at Chewaukee Prairie, which is on the border of Illinois and Wisconsin, 121st and 2nd Avenue. Hopefully, if the winds are right, the hawks will be migrating, and we may see some hawks that are migrating. Hmm. Then on Thursday, November 2nd, at the Racine Northside, Kenosha Northside Library, we have a guest speaker, Kevin Nolan, who is an arborist. He'll be talking about what he does as an arborist. That's at 7 o'clock in the evening. Everyone is welcome. And then we start our November bird viewing walks. They're not really walks because we have spotting scopes set up for everybody to look at the ducks or anything else moving on Lake Michigan. And cool. Those dates are November 4, 11, and 25. And we meet at the Shoup Golf Course next to the Wind Point Lighthouse in Racine. And then on Saturday, November 18th and December 2nd, we meet at the Kenosha Dunes to walk and check out the lakefront in Kenosha. And these start at 9 o'clock in the morning, so you don't have to get up real early like you do when the warblers are migrating. And then on November 17th, we have an owl prowl at Bong Recreational Center at 7 o'clock in the evening. So we're looking for hawks, owls, ducks, and anything else that's moving in. So everything is open to the public, and if you want to check out this, you can go to our website, which is hoyaudubon.org.
Very good. Going back to the matter of interconnectedness and the fact that Hoy Audubon isn't just concerned with birds, I want to give you a couple of minutes to talk about something else that you folks do involving trees and some kind of program called Trees We Love. And I understand Nan has actually been part of this, or at least Sino has been part of this.
Yes.
Right. So tell us about that, Rick.
Well, Trees We Love is a program. It's the idea of one of our members, and she's the a conservation chair for our club. Her name is Sue Schuett. She came up with this idea to have people nominate trees in the area, which they think are outstanding for their species, whether they're large or have some kind of sentimental feelings. And she came up with this idea, and she has worked diligently and it's a labor of love for her. And what we do is we get the nominations, and depending how much money we have from grants or so, we select a certain amount of trees. And this year we have selected 6 trees to get an award. And each award winner gets a bronze plaque with the name of the tree on it. Also a historical writing about the tree and the area, and what the tree has seen over its years historically, and also a framed photo of the tree. So Sue Schuett, Fran Brinkman, John Kredowitz, and Helen Pugh have been on the committee for selecting these trees. And it's just a wonderful program, and Nan has had a tree that was a winner this year.
Yes, I'm very thrilled about that. And we will be highlighting that at our festival this coming Saturday. It's a 220-year-old bur oak.
Wow.
It's a spectacular tree. It's very large, as you might guess. And under its branches, many people have celebrated important milestones of their lives, especially over about the last 3 years. A lot of people have said their vows to one another. Mm. So it's an amazing tree, really
wow.
Beautiful.
Very cool.
So thank you, Trees We Love.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And thank you, Rick Fair, for coming and sharing this bounty of information that you have about birds. I'm so impressed, as always, with the scope of your understanding and knowledge, and also your fervent love for these beautiful creatures that are all around us. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you very much, Greg, for offering me this opportunity.
Glad you could be here. Rick Fair, the education chair for the local chapter of Hoy Audubon. And Nan Calvert, I know you have several things that you want to tell us about, including that aforementioned fall festival.
Yes, I absolutely do. So this coming Saturday from 3 until 9 p.m., Seno Conservancy's Woodland Festival will take place. And we're going to have a lot of things going on. We're going to have a sawmill demonstration. We're going to have live music. We'll be having a barn dance. We will have food all day long. From 5 until 7 p.m., there's a pig roast dinner. There will be tours. There are vendors. It's just going to be wonderful. And if you come, you'll get a chance to see our beautiful award-winning tree in Memorial Field. So we invite everyone to come. I think it's going to be spectacular. Madison Area Herpetological Society will be there with their friends, some reptiles and amphibians, and also Who's Woods Raptor Center will be there with some beautiful birds that you can meet. So the bird people, I think, will like that. Mm-hmm. So we invite everyone to come. It's going to be wonderful. And it is rain or shine.
Very good. And remind our listeners, for someone who has yet to visit Seno, how you get there from Kenosha Racine.
Well, it's really quite easy. The easiest way to get there is just to go west on Highway 50. And you go west until you come to Highway P, as in Peter. And then you turn north, and you go north for about a mile and a half, and there we are. And you'll see our sign, and we have a digital sign telling that, you know, you have arrived, and this is what's happening that day. So it's really quite easy. If you need directions, all you have to do is send us an email or give us a call, and we'll be happy to get you out there.
Wonderful. Anything else to tell us about?
Yes, this is very exciting. On November 4th, it will be the first annual Woodland Makers Fair. It's sponsored by Burlington Garden Center, and it will be held at Seno Conservancy. We will have artisans galore. We'll have jewelry makers and carvers and, oh my gosh, painters and all kinds of people. The food will be provided by the Gouda Girls, so you have to come out and check that out. There will be workshops and demonstrations, tours. It's going to be fantastic. So it's the first, and we hope, of annual Woodland Makers Fair at Seno Conservancy. And finally, Riverbend Nature Center, Root River Sessions from 7 to 9:30. It will be acoustic music series facilitated by the Pure Drop. Check it out on their website. And that is all.
Fantastic. All kinds of things going on in November. And, of course, things will get busier as we approach the winter holidays and all of that.
Yes, it's going to be crazy busy.
Right. Well, in the meantime, Nan Calvert, we're glad that you are willing to make time for the morning show in your busy schedule. Nan Calvert from the Seno Racine Kenosha Land Trust Conservancy. Great to have you here, and look forward to seeing you next month.
Thanks, Greg. It's a pleasure.
And again, Rick Fair, thank you for being with us as well on the morning show. Always
thank
a pleasure
you, Greg,
to have you here.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll look ahead to the special mayoral election coming up in Racine, and also preview for you the performances this weekend and next of Molière's delightful comedy Don Juan. Brian Gill from Parkside's Theater Department will join us. Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. From WGTD's Community Council.